Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 9, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two author interviews lined up for tonight. First, in about 5 minutes, we'll be speaking with Caitlin Zaloom, who is a professor of anthropology at NYU and author of the book Out of the Pits, Traders and Technology, from Chicago to London, an anthropological study of futures traders, which is not the typical subject of an anthropological study. This book just published by the University of Chicago Press. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded earlier today with Lewis Lapham, former editor of Harper's Magazine, founding editor of a new journal that bears his name called Lapham's Quarterly, which should premiere sometime next spring, and author of the book Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration, A Case for Impeachment. And before we get to all that, some economic headlines. This morning, Labor Department reporting first-time claims for unemployment insurance, a very timely indicator of the state of the job market, falling by 20,000 last week after an increase of 19,000 the week before. This is a bouncing around 300 to 320,000 a week, so this is signifying a fairly good but not terrific labor market, which is what we've been seeing for pretty much the entire expansion over the last 5 years. No signs of acceleration, no signs of deceleration, just sort of a B to B minus kind of labor market. The Mortgage Bankers Association, however, reporting an upsurge in its tally of applications for new mortgages, both the new purchase mortgage as well as the refinancing component taking big leaps last week. And I don't know, the housing market had been showing signs of rolling over, but this Mortgage Bankers Association measure is showing some signs of life, especially in the refinancing thing. It seems like a lot of people who took out some really weird experimental mortgages, now finding that the low teaser payments are ratcheting upwards and are trying to refinance if their house value holds up and if their credit holds up. So that may be pushing up the refinancing index, and also people still apparently borrowing money against the value of their houses, so-called home equity withdrawal or a home equity extraction. Still looking pretty strong. Freddie Mac, the federal mortgage insurer and packager, reporting that a very high level of refinancing activity, mortgage equity withdrawal in the last quarter. So the housing market not dead yet. And that kind of borrowing and to spend has been one of the things keeping the U.S. economy expanding despite a mediocre job market. Mediocre income growth for everyone except those in the top brackets. But people have been using their houses as ATMs, and it's kept the consumption machine running for the last 3, 4, 5 years. Unprecedented amounts of debt taken out against the value of housing. $1 to $2 trillion over the last 5 years or so, which even by the standards of the U.S. economy is a very large number. This morning, the University of Michigan reporting that its early tally of consumer attitudes for the month of November falling a bit, something of a surprise, but it could be just noise in the series. But it does. One of the interesting things about these measures of consumer attitudes over the last several years is a tremendous partisan gap, with Republicans feeling very good about the economy, Democrats feeling very bad about the economy. Of course, Republicans are generally richer than Democrats and so normally feel better about the state of the economy. But the gap unusually wide given in the last several years, especially after the 2004 election. It'll be very interesting to see in the coming weeks what Tuesday's results do to this enormous partisan gap, where the Republicans start hanging their heads a little bit and Democrats start puffing out their chests a little bit. We shall see in the coming weeks. And then last Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting a gain of just 92,000 jobs in the month of October, although they did revise their estimates for August and September up sharply. The gains of about 160,000 jobs a month now over the last several months, which is considerably below the long-term historical average for job growth, but pretty good by the standards of this business cycle. And the Labor Department also reporting last month that it had been underestimating job growth through late last year and early this year. The job market a little better than it appeared on the surface, but apparently, and actually some signs of wage increases, which has some of the inflation hawks in Wall Street and the Federal Reserve concerned about that. But for most people, this has been not a very exuberant expansion, so signs of wage increases, although they excite alarm among the owning classes, feels pretty good after 3 or 4 years of wage stagnation for most people throughout the income distribution. And then finally, a word about the election. My inner skeptic is trying to keep me from feeling too good about Tuesday's results. I can't wait for the Democrats to start talking about bipartisanship and healing, instead of launching revealing investigations of what the Bush administration has been up to for the last 5 years. But in any case, it's very satisfying to see the Republicans' nose get rubbed in it. But I would be very cautious about leaping to the conclusion that some liberals have leapt to, which is that the country has taken a sharp turn to the left. That is, I don't think, really true. Polling data shows that independents and moderates were really the source of much of the Democratic gain over 2004 and 2002. And I think you could argue that the Democrats, the Americans are deeply afraid of extremism of any kind, and the Republicans are starting to look very extreme. The Democrats look moderate next to that. So it may be a move to the left in relative terms, but not too far to the left. And then finally, an announcement about an event tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. at the New School, 66 West 12th Street. The guest I will be interviewing in about half an hour, Lewis Lapham, will be there. Gary Young also, who is the author of the book Stranger in a Strange Land. They will be talking about American politics at the New School tomorrow night, 6:30 p.m. 66 West 12th Street. For further information, call 212-229-5488, 229-5488. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Caitlin Zaloom. A little bit from Miss Kitten and the Hacker, Stock Exchange Woman from 2002. And that to set up Caitlin Zaloom, who isn't exactly Stock Exchange Woman, but it's close enough for radio. Welcome, Caitlin Zaloom, who is the author of the book Out of the Pits, Traders and Technology from Chicago and London, just out from University of Chicago Press. And I misidentified her department at NYU. It is not the Anthropology Department, but the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. And welcome to Behind the News, Caitlin.
Hi, Doug.
Well, it's a little unusual for anthropologists to study rich people, to study mostly white people, and to go down to trading floors. So how did you get into this strange line of work for your profession?
Well, I was always interested in culture and economy, and actually I had been very interested in studying that originally in the Middle East. But as I began to investigate the economy of cities like Beirut, I discovered that they were having a lot of trouble actually connecting to the kind of global financial flows that are so important to cities everywhere. And I decided to go from being a more traditional anthropologist studying in the Middle East to studying the kind of heart of capitalism in Chicago and in London.
Now, there is a mini trend within the field of studying up, right, as they say, of looking at banks and trading desks and things like that?
Absolutely, there is. So particularly studying science, even, and studying economic things like banks, women on Wall Street, and there's even a little mini field in studying derivatives markets, which is, of course, what I did on the futures floor of Chicago.
So how do you do your field work?
I got a job, actually, on the trading floor as a clerk first, in a way that was a real kind of object lesson in the way that these exchanges worked in Chicago, which is that I called up a family friend, and he had offered to help me in my research. And so I called him up and I asked him if he would have a cup of coffee and talk to me about what was going on at the exchange. But instead of saying, "Oh, sure, I'll meet you at Starbucks," he said, "Well, why don't you just come down and work for me?" And so he, you know, he,
love that flexible American labor market.
Yeah. He called up the owner of the firm that cleared his trades. That was kind of his sponsor on the floor. And by the next Monday, I had a job. And that's really how the markets worked in Chicago. I mean, it was all about kind of who you knew, what your family and neighborhood connections were. And I didn't expect it, but I was ushered right into the heart of my field site.
And what does a clerk of that sort do?
Well, at first, I worked in the grain room there, which they trade at the Chicago Board of Trade corn, wheat, soybeans, all that kind of meat and potatoes stuff of the American heartland. And I would basically take a piece of paper with an order from the phone bank to a broker in the trading pit. And what that meant was essentially elbowing lots of people out of the way in this incredibly crowded trading floor to try to deliver my little slip of paper into a stack of 600 other slips of paper.
A way of doing business that really hadn't changed in 60 or 70 years.
At 60 or 70 or
well, since the telephone,
150.
Well, yeah. Since the telephone was invented, at
least.
Well, your aim was to find out how these people think and operate, right, and how they form their views of the world and how they develop information. So how do these people develop information? Are the skills of a poker player more relevant than an economics PhD?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. The difference is actually mainly between traders who trade on a trading floor where getting information is really very much tied to the kind of physical competition of the trading pit. So a good trader is always reading the information of fear and elation of his competitors around him and trying to get people to be either scared of him or like him. So there's a lot of kind of emotional kind of work that goes on a trading floor that's really crucial to the kind of economic calculations that traders were able to make there. Now that trading has gone more to the screen, that kind of emotional information is by design really removed. So it's gone from being very personal face-to-face information to being just numbers, really based on numbers.
Yeah, an old friend of mine from college who was an options trader in San Francisco said that when they saw a new face on the floor, they'd say, hey, boys, let's go relieve him of his tuition money.
Ah, exactly.
So my friend was a big guy, big loud voice, and would scare people basically into making dumb trades. And that was the way, the rite of passage. And some people survived and some people didn't. But is that sort of thing you saw on the floor?
Absolutely. And one of the key things for traders in the Chicago pits was being able to move up from the center of the trading pit where all of the new traders were kind of corralled to the top step. And what that meant was that they would try, you know, once they had established themselves a little bit, try to actually stand on the next step up.
That pattern is in the exchange's logo, isn't it?
Yes. That's right. It is. It's the emblem of the exchange. But the traders who would try to move up in the pit weren't really allowed by their peers to be there. So they would literally get shoved off the step. I mean, with a big physical push. Or elbowed every day until they just gave up and went back to their went back to their lowly place on the hierarchy.
Now, how do these people think of what they're doing? How do they are they cynical about what they're doing? Do they think they're really developing information by which people make economic decisions? They just try to make a buck. How do they see their role in the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, they see their own work in two different ways. First, if you ask them to rationalize what the market is about, certainly they say that they provide hedging tools for market participants, and they provide information on those markets for planners and people, say, at the Fed. But their own profit-making, I mean, they're very secure about their own desire for making profit, and they really see their participation in the trading pits as a way of kind of participating in the American dream. I mean, they will say those words to you quite often, that here is a place where men can take lots and lots of risk and make lots and lots of money as long as they are sharp and fast and willing to put it all on the line.
I'm assuming you use that word men deliberately. This is a very male world, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what was it like to be a woman in that world?
It was challenging. The largest pit when I was working on the floor was the 30-year Treasury bond futures pit, which held 600 people, three of whom were women. So the traders themselves weren't very female, but there were more female clerks. Oftentimes people would ask me if I was trying to find a husband, which I was absolutely not trying to find a husband, at least not down there at the time.
Dreamboat trader. What about the people who work in investment banks generally go to fancy schools and wear fancy clothes. The trading culture is different. It's much more of a rough working class or lower middle class kind of environment, isn't it?
Absolutely. So a lot of the people who are traders or who got into trading are the same kinds of people who would be cops and firemen. And in fact, one of my favorite...
But they make 10 times as much money.
They make 10 times... Or they can make 10 times as much money. And I think that one of the really crucial distinctions between people who go down to the trading floor and their cops and firemen brothers is that instead of having a secure state job, I mean, they really have the potential to lose everything. I mean, there's no guarantee that there's no salary, there are no benefits. So it's an incredibly insecure job, but it is one where they have the potential to make, orders of magnitude more money than their brothers. But one of my favorite stories of a trading family was actually that they a number of brothers and sisters got together this was back in the 1950s when the big highways were being built, and their family home was going to be demolished in order to build the expressway. So even though all of the brothers were cops and firemen, very literally cops and firemen, they pooled their money and gave it to the one brother who was a clerk down at the Board of Trade, and he made them rich, and then he trained all of his brothers to be traders, and now they have 13 members of their family on the trading floor, or they did before it was a digital market.
Yeah, that's I should say I'm talking to Caitlin Zaloom, a professor at NYU and author of the book Out of the Pits, just out from the University of Chicago Press. You also did some time in London where it is a much computerized market. People are not running around screaming at each other on floors, right?
Absolutely. The markets went digital in London much earlier on, actually in 2000, probably because the...
Now, Chicago is making that transition now, right?
Chicago, yes. Yes, it is making that transition now, or it's completing that transition now. It's taken almost a decade to go from fully pit to fully digital, but they're pretty much at the end of it now.
So, the culture must be very different if it's all screen based, computer based trading.
It is, and actually, I was just in Chicago, and I went to see one of my informants, as we call them in anthropology. But I went to see one of the people that I worked with, in London, actually, who opened a proprietary trading operation in Chicago. And I asked him this question. He said, well, you know, it used to be all football players, but now it's really Revenge of the Nerds around here. So all of the people who really had an advantage in the pits, who are these very big, very loud guys, as you said, have really been replaced by people who have a lot of math training and who are really fast and who can build models. And so it's gone from being a place where working or even middle class guys can get a foot in to being another place where highly educated, math college trained people.
And so how do the nerds with PhDs see what they do compared to what the working class traders see what they do?
Well, not very differently, really. I mean, they will more quickly go to the explanation that they're creating markets for large institutional investors to hedge risk, probably because those are their friends, the people in the hedge funds and the large banks. But they are equally excited about their potential to make money.
And you actually were a trader when you were in London, right? Not just a clerk.
That's right. Yeah, I worked as a futures trader on the Eurex exchange.
And how'd that feel?
Well, it's very different from being an everyday academic. So it was very exciting to me to be able to work at the kind of speed that you have to work and really kind of second by second watching the computer, not letting your eyes go away for a minute. And but in the end, it was really hard because I'm not the kind of adrenaline junkie that you need to be in order to keep that up.
Well, and do these people trade, you know, either the Chicago style or the London style? Do they have some kind of analysis, some kind of master narrative they're working with, or are they just creatures of the last piece of news that comes across the wires?
They're pretty much, I mean, they're even creatures of the time before what comes across the wires. I mean, because oftentimes the wires are seconds behind what the market does. So their time frame is definitely all about the very second in which they can act, and they tend not to have much analysis at all because it's in some ways not important if you're the kind of trader who is, you know, what they call flat at the end of the day. If they don't have any stake in the markets that go from day to day, then really it's only what happens within that day that is important.
So they could be trading German bonds or pork bellies. It doesn't matter to them, just as long as the numbers move, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. And oftentimes they would say that a good trader can trade anything. And a lot of the traders did trade things that were even off the computer screen. So even though they might be specializing in trading Eurex spreads or something like that, they would always be making a wager on something else on the side, you know, who would walk down the hall next or who, you know, what football team would win, you know, the next weekend.
Yeah, there was an anecdote about, I think, John Shadd, who was the head of the SEC during the Reagan years, came out of some trading house, and it was said of him that he would bet on which of two cockroaches would make it across the floor first. So, you know, just as long as there is risk and money at stake, it didn't matter what the underlying instrument
was. That's right.
Was.
It's all about having a stake. It's all about having a little money in the game.
You said that phrase, a good trader. What makes a person a good trader? And can people be consistently good traders, and how much is luck?
Well, that sort of depends on who you ask, whether or not people can actually be good traders or luck. But if you ask a trader this question, what they say primarily is that discipline is what makes a good trader. And what that means to them is essentially dividing everything that they do in the market from everything that they do outside of the market. So being a good trader is all about creating a little world where nothing matters except what is happening right in front of you in the numbers. And that especially means for them not thinking about the consequences of their actions. So not thinking about what a good or bad trade would mean for their car payments or for their next vacation or for their kids' tuition. All of that has to be put completely out of mind. So being a good trader is really about creating that very enclosed market space.
Well, there's something almost autistic about that. I mean, just being so self-absorbed, and it's kind of antisocial in a way.
Yeah, it's very antisocial.
But on the other hand, these markets are complicated social institutions. How do we reconcile this sort of these individuals and bubbles with the fact that these are very complicated networks of relationships and money flows and all kinds of things?
Yeah, it's a hard thing to reconcile. But there the everyday experience of the people who work in the market is really different from what we might think of it as people observing the market from the outside and trying to make sense of it. So even though there are all of these connections that bring people to the trading floor, I mean, brothers and friends and fathers and neighbors, they tend to think of themselves as these totally autonomous market individuals that economists might really love. So actually being in the market is really different from what we might say about it as observers.
And then what's the mix of rationality and emotion in the way people trade?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the discipline really comes into that for them, that they really try to manage their emotions by keeping limits on what they feel about any given trade. So, it is a little bit autistic that that they try not to have emotional consequences that follow from their actions, that they that a loss, say, will not make them depressed. They really focus on not having an emotional reaction to their trades, whether good or bad.
And do they try to read the mood of other traders, like the mob psychology, and then try to outwit that, or are they just really just looking at numbers?
They try to understand what's going on in the minds of other traders, because it's really important to finding some kind of trend in the market that they can use to make money. That's much easier, obviously, in a trading pit where there are 600 bodies packed together than on a trading screen. So on the trading screen, they'll start to ascribe emotion to what's going on in the numbers so that they can then take advantage of it. So it actually becomes this very strange kind of feedback loop where they're reading stuff in the numbers that isn't at all obvious, like, you know, people are scared or people are, you know, exuberant and maybe I can make some money. But they have to use those kinds of signals in order to make sense of what is otherwise a completely random fluctuation between, you know, 0 and 9.
And do they all go out for beer at the end of the day, or they just run home and try to recover from this stress?
Well, the trading actually, it makes you very, very tense. And of course, there is this really huge adrenaline rush that comes from any kind of risk-taking. So at the end of the day, people have to manage the fact that they're incredibly hopped up still. They go out for a beer something else in order to kind of bring themselves down. I mean, there was a trader that I met in Chicago who, after making lots and lots of money, became a yoga instructor that he'd gotten hooked on while being a trader as his own kind of emotion modulation tool, right? So instead of going out for a beer, he would go get really zen at the end of the day in order to bring himself down.
I guess you can trade better if your chakras are properly aligned. And how long – this doesn't sound like people can last beyond the age of 35 or 40. How long do people last at this game?
People often burn out extremely quickly. And it's a little bit hard to say in these kinds of arenas what happens to them, because the people who don't do well leave really fast. Like in less than a year, but a disciplined trader can last for, you know, like I mean at the very margin last like 20 years, but most people get really burned out after just a few years. And if you look at traders or if you listen to pit traders who've been at it, they sound like they've been 10-pack-a-day smokers because their voices are so worn and the lines in their faces are so deep.
So you're not nostalgic for your days as a trader?
Not really. I'm happy to be back in my office.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Caitlin Zaloom, who teaches at NYU and is the author of the book Out of the Pits, Traders in Technology from Chicago to London, a study of futures traders on the floor and in front of the screens, just published by the University of Chicago Press. And let's take a break for Station ID, and we'll be back to hear from Lewis Lapham.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
And this is Doug Henwood, the show Behind the News. And let's take a little musical break to set up Lewis Lapham, from whom we'll hear in about a minute.
Our greatest security is found in the relentless pursuit of these cold-blooded killers. The front of the new war is here in America. We're fighting a war against evil.
That an excerpt from No W by Ministry, which came out on the Rock Against Bush collection back in 2004, just before the election. And I thought that was a good setup for Lewis Lapham, who is the former editor of Harper's Magazine, is in the process of setting up a new publication called Lapham's Quarterly, which will be a journal of history, which he'll describe at the end of the interview we'll hear in a few minutes. And he is the author of the book Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration, the collection of essays he wrote for Harper's Magazine, published by the New Press. And as I said, you can see Lewis Lapham along with Gary Young tomorrow night at the New School, 66 West 12th Street at 6:30 p.m. And for more information on that, 212-229-5488. And an interview recorded earlier today, Lewis Lapham, author of Pretensions to Empire.
Welcome, Lewis Lapham. First of all, your book is an extended indictment of the Bush administration and the Republican Party for a long bill of crimes and misdemeanors. From the evidence of Tuesday's election, a large part of the public seems to be coming around to your opinion. What do you make of the results?
Well, precisely that. I do think that over time, the book is a collection of essays written over the last 3 years, and increasingly the same observations and proofs have occurred to other people. There have been, as you know, quite a few books within the last 3 months prior to the election pointing to the various corruptions and incompetencies of the administration. I mean, books by Woodward, among others, by Frank Rich. So sooner or later the truth will out.
Do you expect much of a change from the new gang?
No. Well, maybe not. I mean, I'd be very curious to see what they will say about Iraq. I mean, the new Secretary of Defense, Gates, is, as you probably know, a born bureaucrat. I mean, a man who's apt to take orders well and not a creative thinker. So as to who will be directing our strategy, I assume it will go back into the hands of Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft and some of the people who advised the first President Bush. What that will mean in practice, I don't know.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of names that I was just about to mention myself. This seems almost as if there's an adult supervision coming in to look over the shoulder of Georgie.
Yeah, young man has made a mess. and now somebody has to try to clean it up.
About the Bush administration, we've had many lying and ignorant presidents and many corrupt and incompetent administrations over the decades. Is there something uniquely bad about these guys, or are they just the latest incarnation of a pretty dismal species?
Well, I think that what was bad about them was the...
You're speaking about the past tense now.
Yeah, well, I think, I would hope that the least that the Democratic control of the Congress will accomplish is to put a check on the abuses of power that have been coming down out of the executive branch over the last 6 years. It was the willingness or the intention, what seemed to me to be the intention of the Bush administration to bring about regime change in the United States, more so than in Central Asia. The violations of the Constitution, the innumerable instances of the president exercising arbitrary power, overriding congressional legislation with signing statements, the vision of a brave new world, I mean, as if they were more revolutionary and radical than other presidents. I mean, yes, there have been incompetent presidents. There have been presidents that haven't been too bright and, you know, with all the usual human imperfections. But I can't remember any administration that was so eager to impose in a utopian-like vision on the United States. I mean, my knowledge suggests that most other presidents were conservative of the principal institutions of the American government.
Were you surprised by the way the public, at least for several years, put up with the Bush administration? Was it just September 11th that scared them into submission? Or is there a deeper passivity or even a yearning for authoritarianism in the broader public?
Well, I think there is that, too. I think that beginning around the turn of the 1980s, or 1980 with the advent of the Reagan administration, the notion that politics were not as important as the market. In other words, the big decisions were to be made by, were the ones, you know, having to do with the economy or having to do with the international finance capitalism and not with money, that is to say, and not with politics. Large portions of the American public seem to lose interest in politics as the vehicle of their freedom and their liberties and of the, you know, what the country is about. So the notion that one could buy the future instead of making it became ever increasingly received. The political consciousness or the political muscle withered, I think. And now the question is, can it be revived? And we will maybe see some of that in what happens in the new, in this current, or in the next year's Congress.
Bush himself is a curious character. He emerged out of the old Northeastern WASP elite, Andover, Yale, Harvard, Greenwich. His granddaddy was a senator. His father was president. Yet he tried to remake himself into the Texas rancher with a brief detour as a failed oil man. What do you make of this trajectory?
I don't know, Doug. I mean, what do you make of it? It's a curious trajectory. I mean, he strikes me as a... In many ways, maybe it's rebellious adolescence. I mean, there's something about Bush and about his administration that strikes me as somehow a form of adolescent rebellion. You know, the notion that on some of the radical conservative sides, people like Paul Weyrich, who will say that the best government is no government. I mean, the idea that we can shrink the government to the size that it could be drowned in a bathtub. I mean, these kinds of notions are I think, maybe trying to overthrow the institution of government, and it's something of an adolescent rebellion in it. And there's also the Bush's being twice born. I mean, the sense that he has, that he's imbued with virtue, or that he stands on principle. I mean, when I saw the press conference that he gave yesterday when he was announcing the resignation of Rumsfeld and talking some of his thoughts about the election, saying that the Republicans had been given a thumping and trying to answer questions about his various attitudes toward Iraq and the war and expressing his frustration with the speed of victory in Iraq, I had the sense that he was relieved that he could say, all right, I have stuck by my principles. I know I am right. Maybe, and if something goes wrong, it will probably be because the Democrats, now in control of Congress, have failed to properly appreciate the nature of the endless war on terrorism. But there was something, I did get the sense of a relief that he could now stop playing the part of an adult and relax into the part of the virtuous adolescent.
I'm speaking with Lewis Lapham, former editor of Harper's Magazine, editor of the forthcoming Lapham's Quarterly, and author of the book Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration.
Your book opens with a review of the emergence of the new right in the 70s, the whole the noise machine, the think tanks, the evolution of the foundations that funded what came to be policy in the 80s and 90s. Just give a little review of how we got here. Out of what did this emerge in the 70s?
Well, I think this emerges in the 70s out of the events of the late, or out of the events of the 60s. Say in 1960, the entire bias or the consensus of opinion in America is liberal. That would have been true not only of the media, that would have been true of the Congress, that would have been true of the philanthropic foundations and of the universities. I mean, the country imbued with the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt notions of freedom from fear, freedom from want, so forth, the four freedoms, and a liberal idea. And then comes the 60s, and comes the assassinations of the two Kennedys and of Martin Luther King, and the periods of race riot and the anti-Vietnam the opposition to the war in Vietnam. And among the country's possessing and property classes, there is a genuine, I think, fear that the whole fabric of the society is being torn apart, and that the ground is sliding out from under their feet, and that liberal idea has gone too far, and now we have revolution and permissiveness, and the what has happened to the old order, the hierarchy, you know, the very foundations of society. I think people, are, as I say, property classes got genuinely frightened, as they were in an earlier period in the American history, when confronted with a populist movement in the 1880s, and again with a progressive movement in the early 1900s. So suddenly they began to look at each other, people of, you know, corporate overlords, captains of industry, wealthy individuals of various kinds, and began to think, suddenly said to themselves, well, ideas matter. And we don't have any ideas, really. We have Bill Buckley's magazine, National Review, and we have a couple of other authors on whom we can rely, but we don't have our intellectual armament, and we have to go out and make it. and we have to assemble it outside of the universities and outside of the media mainstream. So we will set up a series of foundations and think tanks, and this begins to happen in the early 70s, the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, so forth. And they replicate one another, and they over the course of the 70s, they wax and multiply, and the scholarship that supports these ideas tends to be, I would say, reactionary. But it's also intelligent, because there are, by this time, clearly weaknesses in the liberal consensus.
Yeah, you hint at being somewhat intrigued by some of that in the 70s, especially Irving Kristol.
Yeah.
What was the appeal at that moment?
Well, it was intelligence, and it was their, it was critical thinking and seeing some of the foolishness of the 60s and seeing the liberal idea being broken down from a conviction into a sentiment. And the dispersal of the liberal idea into various special interest kind of sectors, feminist rights, race discrimination, age, so on. I mean, it became a set of attitudes. What was called the limousine liberal in those days, if you remember the. The idea that people would affect sympathy for the poor and the dispossessed and so forth, but not really act in any way to change it. And it was the criticisms on the conservative side of the argument in the 70s that were, I thought, many of them very acute. But when they come to power, with the election of Reagan in 1980, their criticism kind of runs out of energy, and they become their ideas become as stale and hidebound as the ones that they were criticizing. I think you can say that we've come to an end of an era. David Brooks makes that point in a newspaper this week, that the conservative ascendancy, the great ideas as taught by Newt Gingrich, who prides himself, as you know, and calls himself a teacher of civilization, and I think many of these ideas are going to be up for revision.
Michael Lind, I think, called this the rise of a counter-establishment in the 70s, that right-wing ascendancy. But now that right-wing, the new right, seems to be crashing, there is no counter-establishment that occupies an analogous role to what the right did 30 years ago.
No, there isn't. And there have been various attempts, as you probably know, by the, mutterings on the liberal side of the aisle by people like John Podesta and George Soros,
and don't forget the blogosphere,
and the blogosphere. So, I mean, there have been various attempts to try to engender or organize or bring forth a liberal renaissance somehow. But to my knowledge, so far, without success. I mean, I don't. Maybe you know, but I don't know of. A coherent body of opinion or counter-establishment that it stands to take the place, or a shadow cabinet, a shadow intellectual cabinet that's prepared to take the place of the conservative one that is still operating well. I don't know. I mean, I leave out the blogosphere and I leave out the talk radio. I mean, Rush Limbaugh and people like him are that is 80 or 90% of what people hear on their radios.
Your book leads up to a call for the impeachment of Bush. Now that we see this smash-up so visibly in the results of the election, and, of course, Howard Dean and Nancy Pelosi said to have taken impeachment off the table, is it still necessary? Would you like to see that taken just for the beauty of it?
I really don't know. I mean, I would have said, you know, last week I think I would have said yes, because on the ground that what we could really see was the constitutional crisis. In other words, the severe abuses of power on the part of the president and the Republican majority in the Congress. But now maybe it will come out in the with the new composition of you know, now that the Democrats have both houses of Congress, maybe we will see some kind of airing of, I mean, some kind of recognition as to what the Bush administration was about, which in turn would force out of the on the liberal side some kind of the coherent counter-establishment that you were talking about. Maybe, you know, that would be a way of forcing the birth.
God save us from bipartisanship. Finally, after about 30 years at Harper's, you've left, moved on to start a new venture. Just tell us a little bit about that.
I've started a new venture because I've always been an amateur historian. I've been started out in life wanting to be a history professor and ended up as a journalist. But the new quarterly journal is come out, as it says, four times a year, and it'll take an idea that or a notion or a topic that is current in the news, relation between church and state, or the dream of empire, or the idea of the institution of war, predicament of women, you know, the uses of celebrity and fame. I mean, some kind of an idea that has been around for a long time. And then I would write a brief introduction and then run out 40, 50, 60 texts on that topic, arranged more or less chronologically, but borrowing from the great books. In other words, it's the great books made topical. I try to bring Homer or Thucydides or Shakespeare or Cicero or Macaulay and Churchill to bear on the present tense. The notion is that we can learn from history, and that without the notion is that acute, accurate, perceptive observations about the human predicament don't become obsolete.
And when might we see a debut issue?
I would hope by next spring. I'm going to start it as a website, and then maybe do a variation of it as a radio show, and then by next spring, hope to have it in the form of a quarterly.
All right, well, good luck with it, and thanks for joining us.
I've been speaking with Lewis Lapham, who is the former editor of Harper's Magazine and author of the collection Pretensions to Empire, Notes on the Criminal Folly of the Bush Administration, which consists of essays he wrote for that magazine. He is also the editor of the eponymous periodical forthcoming Lapham's Quarterly. You can see Lewis Lapham along with Gary Young, author of the book Stranger in a Strange Land, whom I interviewed last June about that book, tomorrow evening, Friday evening, 6:30 p.m. at the New School, 66 West 12th Street in Manhattan. That's the New School, 66 West 12th Street at 6:30 Friday evening. The number for more information, 212-229-5488. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on until the evening. Till next week, goodbye. Oh, and I don't know what's coming next politically, but how about a little bit of this? This is from The Exploited, Class War, from about 25 years ago. Down the rubber sheds.